Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Zinquiry. My guest tonight is Jeremy J. Bomberg. He's a professor of nanotechnology and photonics in the Cavendish Laboratory at the University of Cambridge. And we're talking about his new book, The Secret Life of Science, How It Really Works and Why It Matters. Jeremy, welcome to the show. It's a real pleasure to talk to you.
I'm great to talk to you.
This book was a real pleasant surprise. First of all, because it did exactly what it set out to do. It talks about science as a profession, about what it's like to do science, how scientists do science, and a lot of other things. I realized I've never read a book like this before.
So it's weird being a scientist and then realizing that nobody seems to have written a book quite like this before. People have written books anecdotally about what it feels like to do their particular science.
And that's them. That's just them talking specifically about themselves.
Yeah, so I think people always feel maybe scientists don't like generalizing. They only know their own experience. But I felt there was a different book here. There's something interesting about trying to give people a flavor of what it's actually generally like to be a scientist. And then from that, like, well, what do we have to worry about?
Exactly right. And this is a book, I want to emphasize this, for the general public. But it's also a book for people who are thinking about entering the sciences and actually for people starting their career route.
I would say that, yeah, a surprising number of scientists have read it and commented on it, and it wasn't really for them. There's a lot of people also involved in science who are not scientists, but are really important in the system. There are, people who are in charge of agencies that fund science.
Oh, yeah.
People in media who look at science and, take its results and try and communicate them.
And this is in your book, too, all of these things.
Yeah, exactly. It's not really just about scientists. It's about a much bigger range of people who are all involved in some way. And I think people around the edges, who are involved in the system in one part of it really they've not had a chance to see the system as a whole as well. And so it's for those people as well.
For people not in the sciences, and you write this in the beginning of the book, basically we take science for granted and we have sort of a fantasy idea about what scientists do, how they operate, and usually involves a lab coat. And a lab. And that's about all we non-scientists think about science.
Well, the other model is that we sit in an office or an ivory tower on our own thinking up
that's
great
right.
smart ideas. And somehow there's a sort of a leakage. Maybe like there's a pipe or something and the ideas go down into the smart person in the lab. And then there's another pipe and it goes to somebody else who happens to work in a company making a production line.
And that's, surprisingly enough, people, that's not how it works. You use the concept of an ecosystem to talk about science. Elaborate on that.
Yes. So an ecosystem shows much more of the complexity of lots of people interacting together, lots of components interacting together. And, particularly a biological ecosystem, we can think about the plains of Serengeti or the Rockies of Colorado. There are enormous numbers of different species interacting with each other. They all together make an ecosystem that we like to think about as nature. It's what we go out to explore or to look into. But at the same time, if you look down to it, people always emphasize survival of the fittest. They're actually involved in a huge struggle just to exist and pass on their genes and propagate. And that struck me as quite a good description of the science system. So I sort of started out from that, and then I found this is quite a valuable metaphor. So scientists often like to feel that they're only people who are important in the system, but it's just not true. Lots of other people are important, and also the ways they interact with each other are really important. And so this sense of competition of lots of different spheres together actually creating this whole system actually gives a fair idea of what science is like.
It's interesting, too, because the illustrations that you use to illustrate different aspects of the ecosystem of science look like ecology illustrations of about an environment.
Yeah, well, some I had to sort of make myself in some ways, and some I had to try. There's an illustration which tries to go from a natural ecosystem idea of like the water cycle, and then it tries
That's
to
right.
have like this life cycle of scientists as well. There are lots of these ideas, I think, which are really quite fruitful and don't seem to have been picked up before. So there's an interesting, social science. This really is a book of social science
right.
about scientists. And I'm not a social scientist. I'm a practicing scientist. So you'd have thought I'd get absolutely killed by social scientists who should have written this book. But it doesn't seem to have worked that way. And I sort of feel that, again, they've concentrated on very small areas, but not this big picture, and therefore I think this is quite a good way to approach it as a you know, the whole big system.
I think one of the geniuses of the book is that you ask the very basic questions that sometimes seem like they're so basic or so simple that nobody bothers to ask them. And one of them is, why should we care? Why should we care about what scientists do? Answer that.
Yes. Well, we all pay for it is one way of thinking about it. And, you know, it doesn't matter if you're thinking about your taxes or what you buy as a product because somebody's had to do the research for that or a charity that you're interested in solving a problem. So, you know, we're paying a number of times over for our science, and we're normally pretty canny about what we spend our money on. We just assume science is great, and it's an investment that, by and large, politicians push, because if you tell anybody in society, oh, we want to spend some money on some science, nobody really complains. I'm not getting that wrong, but I actually want to look at it in much more detail. Is this, you know, what is the right investment? Is it going the right way at the moment? How good of an investment is it? Are we going to carry on creating all this science that we've become used to at the same rate, or is it changing?
And that's one of the challenges, and you talk about this later in the book. You know, people try to think like, okay, what science is going to have a payoff later? In other words, that it's going to create something that will lead to a technological or some other kind of development that will either make money or benefit society. That's not so easy to predict.
No, there are lots of very smart scientists who look back on their career. You know, they've done very well, or technologists who've made a billion from a company, and they say, "Oh, well, I can pick the winners now." But actually, I don't believe it's true.
I don't either.
Huge amount of randomness. There's something then about making sure your system is diverse as possible.
Right.
So that, because if you think you know the answer, you're generally only picking a certain number of answers. And science has a habit of telling us that the answer is not always in one place. So you need to look broadly. So we'll come back later maybe to this idea of bandwagon. So the fact that you really need to make sure scientists are looking in a whole range of different directions. They don't just, you know, focus on a few of them. And that's part of this problem about people picking winners.
Yeah, and a good example that you give in the book is lasers. That for a long time, people didn't know what lasers were going to be good for.
Yeah, it's a neat thing. You know, you can make this beam of light, and you can imagine a ray gun, but at the start, yeah, it's not really going to do that. A 100-watt light bulb has got more power than my laser. But, you know, of course, then people started to find a use for it, but only after it had gone through transmutations in different areas. And so often we find that in science, and I try and draw some picture of that, is that you have this idea of utility of the science and also how applied it is to start with. We start off something often very pure, you know, it's disconnected from everything.
Right.
We found something, and then gradually people find uses for it in a particular area. And then it might go back and suggest more science. We actually use that to be able to do something new. And so often science proceeds in sort of parallel streams, and these connections between them only happen sporadically. And that's when suddenly there's a jump in what we can do, and that bleeds over into technology.
Now, you break science down interestingly. You break it down into the simplifiers and the constructors. Talk to me about what each one does.
Yeah, so often in the media we have this idea, mostly, you know, the science in thinking up the great ideas wherever they are, that's the sort of simplifier idea. It's this idea about sort of taking apart the universe. It might be, you know, smashing electrons together to figure out what they're made of, or taking apart a cell to see how does it actually work, or trying to figure out how the brain thinks. So these are, you know, we find a system, we take it apart, we try and, you know, fiddle with it. How does it work? No, that's the kid who takes things apart their parents' distraction. It's a very, you know, good model of science and gets people into science, but actually most science is not done in that guise at the moment. So the idea of constructors are, we put things together that we've learned how to build, and we get completely different things out than we expected. And that's often on the line to the science that we use in technology or ways that we build things that are not found in nature. And often that happens because we're trying to do simplifier science. We try and figure out how something works, and we say, oh, what's the simplest system we could make to test that idea? And then we'll build something that's simple, then we go, oh, what happens if we do that? And as soon as we ask that question, we're doing something now a bit different from simplifier science. We're starting to construct new things. So this idea of constructor science is a bit different. It's very different, actually, from applied science, you know, just because we have a problem and we're trying to solve that problem. It's still very open-ended. It's like a playground, but we're making new things that are not found in nature. And it happens all the way through scientists, from chemistry, physics, mathematics as well. Even in engineering, there's that element. And it's actually, that's the largest number of scientists. And as a society, party. I don't think we really see that at all.
Well, it's interesting because you actually tried to figure out, are there more simplifiers or constructors? And you use different things. You actually used Nobel Prizes, which you fully admit is just sort of a incredibly rough and silly gauge. But are there more simplifier scientists or more constructor scientists?
So I think it's fairly clear there are a lot more constructor scientists. So even a fairly conservative estimate gives about two-thirds constructor, and it's likely, you know, much more than 8%, in fact. So when a field starts, we might be, you know, starting taking things apart. But very quickly it moves on, and, you know, fields are often 200 years old, and they still go back into simplifier parts at different times, but by and large they become more and more dominated by constructors. And you can see a little bit of it from Nobel Prizes. I hate the cult of picking out a few individuals.
Oh, yeah.
Because so much of science is collaborative. Even if people are competing, they're actually collaborating with each other. But still, it shows you there are big ideas that came about. And actually, more of them now become things that were never found in nature. They were a constructed system, but they have incredibly unusual and interesting properties that open up entirely new fields.
One of the things you talk about, and a lot of people may not realize this, is that there is a rise and fall of scientific fields, that something's all of a sudden, it's all the buzz is in there, and then it falls away. Talk to me about that.
Actually, the interesting example is my own father, who was a scientist, and actually that was the reason I sort of said I would never ever become a scientist, because, you know, I saw the academic life, and I was going to be working in industry and doing great things, and, you know, and I did for many years, and I got sucked back into academic science. But he was a geneticist. Only there wasn't such a thing as genetics when he did his PhD. So he actually was working in a chemistry department for somebody who didn't believe that DNA carried the genetic information.
Oh,
and, of course, that failed pretty badly. So he actually founded a department in the UK in genetics. And then by the time at the end of his career, there was no such thing. Well, the genetics departments became subsumed into everything on the biological and even physical sciences. So it just became a tool. It wasn't a department in its own right. So that's one sort of arc you get of something. You know, it's a new thing. Everybody uses it, and then it becomes something that's accepted, and it becomes a tool for everything else.
I think taxonomy had the same problem when genetics came along. Biology all became about genetics, and then sort of the larger biological fields that people used to do all the field work were not as important. And
now people are worried about that.
So I know. They're trying to recorrect it. But there is an ebb and flow of what happens in science.
Yeah, and you know, who chooses those ebbs and flows? you think, of course, well, maybe, you know, some sensible people choose, but it's not like that at all.
No. And you talk about that extensively in the book. By the way, you're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight, Jeremy J. Baumberg, professor of nanotechnology and photonics in the Cavendish Laboratory at the University of Cambridge. And we're talking about his new book. It's one of those things. It's a book, I have never read a book about the subject before. It is about how science is done, the secret life of science, how it really works and why it matters. Jeremy, there's so many great sections. I wish I could do an entire interview just about publishing, because that chapter really knocked me out. But let's talk about what science do scientists hear about, and what that chapter ends up being about. And this is, I find this really funny, the conferences. The conferences are out of hand.
Yeah, people don't even know why they go anymore. So that's actually one of the reasons I started writing the book, because I got fed up with colleagues telling me, oh, it's terrible, I have to go to this conference in, you know, Barbados or, you know, the Midwest or wherever it was and around the world and somewhere in Europe. Well, why do you go then? Oh, I have to go. Why? And the funny thing is that, you know, nobody tells scientists you have to have conferences. It's all from within the system. But now it's become this, you know, this way of people advancing their careers. It is a way that people hear about new science and they find out about new things. But there's nothing stopping proliferation of conferences. And in fact, the EU in the last 20 years put enormous amounts of extra money into science. And at least 10 or 15% of that has to go to subsidies for the airlines and the hotels and restaurants. So, you know, of course, the EU is completely happy with that. It's very important in Europe. But you have to ask, you know, okay, well, there must be a time when enough is enough. What's the right number of conferences? Now, the really interesting thing is nobody has actually figured out if, you know, it's like $20 billion has gone in the last 10 years on science in Europe on this sort of area. So was that money well spent or not? And so nobody even knows how many how many conferences scientists go to. Nobody collects that information. It's astounding to me. But, you know, particularly also there's a serious element, which conferences scientists really like and they don't like. Well, one of the things that I'm actually doing alongside the book, there's a website called thesciencemonster.com. And I actually have some surveys there where I'm trying to collect both from scientists, but also, you know, media people who cover meetings.
Right.
You know, do they like certain conferences or not? We'll talk about that later. But so it's really interesting. Starting to get, you know, we have several hundred now responses, and you know that will climb. And just, you know, why do people say they go to conferences? And there are these massive ones. There are some which are like 10,000 people.
Well,
it's like
I want to talk about. There's three different sort of levels of conferences you talk about. There's the workshop, the topical meeting, and then the monster conference that you were just talking about is the discipline conference. It's like the meeting of the American Psychological Association would be a good example of that. Those are the big conferences, the giant conferences that like just thousands of people attend. And as you write, all these conferences, this proliferation of conferences had an effect on the way the papers are presented. Like the time you get is shorter.
Yeah. So, you know, if people go to a conference, they're expecting to talk. So the more scientists, and so they all need to have some time, and you can't get people for more than a week, essentially. So you just have to make them smaller. So typically conferences, you know, people give 10-minute talks. They go for a week, give a 10-minute talk. And there might be 2 minutes for questions, but generally they have to spend time talking over that. And maybe somebody asks one question.
Well, this is another thing that you brought up that I thought was a personal anecdote. It was really important. You were at a conference, this is years ago. And while a person was presenting, one of the people in the audience got up and really started criticizing and essentially debating the person who was giving the paper. And there was this really sort of awkward back and forth, but you found it really useful that you ended up learning a lot from sort of on both sides of the question, and that you write, this debate is like gone now.
Yeah, it by and large has gone. There are a few meetings that encourage it, and you know, I'm a huge proponent of those. But generally, it's transmit mode. So that reflects probably part of our society as well. So politicians, it's more the case that people are in transmit mode. They don't really answer questions. They just go off onto their next topic and tell you about that. But yet science is really built on that argument. And so the best conferences I go to now are ones where you actually have like a half-hour slot. And you actually had to have sent everybody at the conference a written document beforehand, which is what you're going to talk about. And then you have 5 minutes to summarize that. And then you have to shut up. And then they ask you questions. And then all the questions are recorded and your answers, and they're published along with your document. Those are fantastic because there's nowhere to hide. So the people start out, you know, talking about their stuff. It all sounds great. And then slowly it gets unpicked. Somebody asks a killer question. And you can see the evasion. So somebody asks it again, but actually, instead of being, you know, you might have thought that would get down to really nasty a level, but actually people are really interested in the science, so what really happens is it becomes a scientific discussion. It's a bit divorced.
See, that seems ideal.
That is ideal, yeah. But it takes more time, so fewer people can speak, and so you have to really restrict things, but those are meetings that, you know, like a shot I go to.
Now, let's talk about the science that the public gets to hear about, and I found that discussion in that chapter really fascinating. One of the first things you point out is that we never hear about most of the science that gets done, and people have got to realize that we only hear about a tiny little fraction of the science that gets done.
Yes. So, you know, you always hear these great discoveries, and it always seems this ferment of stuff. But, you know, often the same things come out again, and I start to ask why. And then you just look at about the number of projects that are done and the number that actually get aired in mainstream media. You know, 0.001% or something like that. And that means you start asking, well, who's choosing this? Is that random?
Right.
Yeah. I don't know if that, you know, really speaks to you because you start thinking about all the things you've been reading about.
Yeah, I mean, that's why that chapter was important to me, because you asked the big question, like, first of all, science journalists and people who promote science and talk about science to the public are really important, but you asked the question, like, what makes good copy? Why are they choosing one science story over another? And there's some obvious answers. There are certain ones certain stories that are naturally going to be of interest to the public. And journalists just know that. Like anything about cancer or a cancer cure is a good example that you talk about.
It's true, but it's not just that. It's the fact how, you know, our own attention spans as readers are getting shorter.
Yeah, you're right.
And
you're right.
So they're, I mean, it's not really the reporter's fault. They're just responding to what we want. They want to give us what we want. So they have to give us something that we can jump into really easily. If I say cancer, you already know. You have a constellation of memes and ideas around that. You already know what I'm talking about.
Right.
If I said Polariton, you haven't the faintest idea. So that's the difficult thing. It's easier to write a story about cancer than it is about Polaritons. They might be both interesting and go off in all sorts of directions. But as a copywriter, I know I can get better into the story because you won't ask so many questions on the way going into that story.
Yeah, other topics, anything that has to do with the weather or the human genome. Those are the ones that translate into public.
Is good.
Yeah,
tasty,
yep.
Yeah. You know, we've read all these ones. Yeah.
But you know what's interesting is you analyze the stories that came out in Scientific American, and you write that they're sort of split evenly between the physical and life sciences, and this is true. We don't hear a lot about chemistry or math as stories, and certainly huge things are going on in both of those fields. But the public very rarely ever hears about it, especially math, I want to mention, unless it's some kind of weird, quirky thing. You're not going to hear about anything from math at all.
Yeah, it has to be the hero type. You hear about the person and not the math, actually.
Yeah. I was surprised about chemistry. Like, you would think chemistry would be popular.
Yeah, chemistry became one of these things that, you know, we depend on it so much. Every plastic around us, everything is to do with chemistry. Maybe becoming a bit mainstream, but also I think it's because the really interesting parts of chemistry became interdisciplinary. So there are parts which are related to healthcare, like pharmaceuticals.
Right,
so
right.
You do hear about stories like that, but it's sort of what you read in healthcare. The chemistry bit is a bit diminished on that side. And then there are other things like materials, which it's gone to things like nanoscience, nanomaterials,
yeah.
Which is more my own area. So there's huge amounts of chemistry there, very interdisciplinary, but it doesn't really get taught as chemistry or told as chemistry. And chemistry is a big part of it still.
I think
those are really interesting areas, but I guess what happened was chemistry itself as a word became a little bit like a toxic brand. Now, chemistry symbolized dull sort of stuff you weren't so interested in, so it didn't manage to get rid of that tradition. I mean, it's not true, but it's an interesting thing. So
well,
it's a sort of perception in the public.
If chemistry is toxic, mathematics is like the Black Death. Because people hear mathematics and literally walk the other way.
It's traditionally the thing, if you don't want to talk to anybody at a party, you say you're a mathematician, and then, you know, you get a nice piece of time, you can go and check your email, whatever you want.
Does it, you know, one of the things that matters, and you talk about this, is if science fiction stories pick up some scientific idea, that ends up popularizing. You were talking about nanoparticles. Nano is now huge in science fiction and on TV and in movies. And so there's a recognition, a brand name recognition.
Yeah, absolutely. So every time I do something, I publish a paper and I talk to the public about it, they said, hasn't that been done already? I read that in a book a few years ago. But no, it's, you know, because it's hard to catch up. The ideas, like most science, the ideas are easy, but do we have it? Do we have unrollable screens, you know, foldable computer screens or anything like that? No. When we do it, people will say, oh, finally you got there. You know, rather than, what a miracle. So it's interesting both ways. But I made a comment in the book that probably the best way to get your science popularized is first to write the novel about it, the science fiction novel, and then invent some technology and then bring it back into the science.
Sadly, that's true. So let's talk about the term science branding. Is that what that's about?
Yes. I mean, what I like about science is there's still something underneath it that's real.
You
can't bullshit with the world.
You're right. You're absolutely right.
Yeah, so there's lots that you can try and talk about, but then you try and delve underneath it. And now, you know, because is there something really in that story or not? And either there is or there isn't. And that's why science is still very robust at the core, which is something I'm trying to emphasize in the book. The core is still not flaky, but there is a big social construct about how we do it. But we create something out of it, which I call sort of this web of knowledge, not like the internet, but this web of knowledge that all interacts together. All these very, very fantastic sort of forests that we can actually then milk for our society, we can use. And it's that we take this sort of very argumentative, competitive social construct, and out of it distills knowledge which somehow goes rigorously that we can use for the future. That's sort of an amazing thing that we've created.
Do books still matter? Scientists writing books, I'd like to think it matters, but I don't think it does because most people don't read anymore. One of the great examples of that, I think, is Stephen Hawking's A Brief History of Time, a book that like thousands of people bought but nobody read. But it created the phenomena of Stephen Hawking.
It did. Why did people buy that book?
And nobody read. Well, I think they started to read it and then realized it was actually like seriously hard and then gave up. I mean, that's going to be the most – I think that's one of the best examples of a book that was a bestseller that almost nobody read.
And I guess it gave people the illusion that they could start thinking about these areas where science – and it's the philosophy and ideas in the science that I think really interest people. How do you think about these things? And, you know, and philosophy, we think we can talk about because it's our understanding of our place in the world as well. So I think it gets people on that road, and then it taught people that actually to do this stuff right, it's hard as well. You've got to grapple with ideas. When people gave up, I don't think they gave up in frustration, but so they felt they were a little bit there. They were sort of skating over the surface, and they just gave up because it got too much to handle. But they didn't give up in misery or distress, I think. maybe you'd correct me.
It looked good on your shelf. It gave other people the impression that you had read the book. That's what that was about. That was
you hope that my book, you know, the it looks like black and it's beautiful that way. So that was very important as well.
It was. The design of the book was really good. It's interesting today to compare two science stories that are going on. There's a lot about neutrinos currently going on in the news, and there's a lot about discovery of water on Mars. I think people have been trying, and I'm fascinated. I've interviewed a lot of people who do research in the neutrinos, and I'm fascinated by that. But people keep trying to push it as a science story, but I don't believe the public is buying it. They're more interested in water on Mars.
Yes. Why one rather than the other? Water on Mars just somehow grabs us. People have been doing it for so long, and, you know, will we finally find it out? And
life on Mars, it goes back to H.G. Wells.
Yeah, it does, exactly. It's the science fiction again that leads everything. In the end, of course, neutrinos are pretty amazing because they go straight through Mars.
I know.
Flicker. And, you know, as a way of trying to understand something like a big body over there or even our own, the inside of the Earth, which we don't understand very much about at all, neutrinos might in the end turn out to be more useful, but there we go.
We're completely out of time. My guest tonight has been Jeremy J. Bomberg, professor of nanotechnology and photonics in the Cavendish Laboratory at the University of Cambridge, talking about his new book. We could have been talking about this book for years. It's really fine. The Secret Life of Science, How It Really Works and Why It Matters. I recommend this book to everybody. Jeremy, it's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.